Hello, and welcome to the second Rest is History bonus episode. The amazing thing is that so many of you are still with us after the first bonus episode. That's very, very gratifying, isn't it?
And encouraging, very encouraging.
Yeah, it's very encouraging.
Let's see what we can do about that today.
So we've both got colds, haven't we, Tom? Not COVID. You were complaining to me that you were ill with no excuse.
I've been so ill.
With no possibility of martyrdom.
Shivers in the heart of the bones. Miserable time. And I've been absolutely convinced it's COVID. And it isn't.
And it isn't. So you're ill for nothing.
Ill for nothing.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's very sad.
But we're being so brave, struggling against our cold, coming out here for you, the listener.
All right. Well, let's get some order into this, Tom. We're going to go through some sort of general questions, then we'll talk specifically about a couple of recent episodes, because we've had, obviously, I mean, the Discord thing has gone kind of mad, hasn't it? I mean, when I look,
I know, and I want to apologize. I've been so ill over the past few days, I haven't had a chance to look at it.
Utterly useless, I think.
I know. Confined to bed.
But we had a really nice question, which our producer pointed out to us, from friend of the show, C. Brogan Savage, who I think I met at Podicom. And she says, I would love to know the origin story of Tom and Dominic's friendship, assuming they are friends, that is. So this is like a sort of superhero origin story. And then we'll come back to superheroes because Tom Holland has things to say. So, Tom, the origin story. She's an Athelstan, says Jack. She is an Athelstan, as all the very finest people are. So, Tom, I remember when we first met. Do you remember?
It was a quiz, wasn't it?
It was. It was the Little Brown entry into the pen quiz.
Yeah. So every year, not every year now because it's been kiboshed, but under normal circumstances, Penn, which is a wonderful charity, does a quiz and various literary teams enter that. And among them was Little Brown, who at the time published both of us.
They did. They were cruelly betrayed by one of their authors, weren't they?
Yes. Sam Brooke. So I obviously regarded Dominic with deep suspicion.
Had you done it before, that quiz?
I had.
See, I'd never done it before.
And I'd been published by Little Brown for several years before I met you.
You had.
And they said, this is our brilliant new historian.
Yeah, you were.
He's wonderful. He's great. His books are splendid. So
you
obviously,
hated
I disliked you.
Well, I had been sent my editor, when I was writing my own book, Never Had It So Good, my editor sent me Rubicon.
Did he?
And said, this is the kind of thing.
And I you never told me that.
No.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to hear that.
And
so you must have loved me.
Well, I think, no, because I didn't read it. Because out of outrage, I just put it on a shelf and thought, oh, I'll never read that.
Oh, you didn't hurl it out the window.
No, I didn't. But I just put it aside and thought, as if I need tips from other historians. And then I only read it after we'd done the quiz. So we were on this quiz team. I can remember going, we didn't win, did we? We came about 10th or something.
Fourth or something.
I think we did quite poorly, actually.
I think we did all right. I think we were
The moment that made me think, this person is he's worthy of some consideration, was there was a question to which the answer was, I can't remember whether it was John Pertwee or Tom Baker. It involved an intricate knowledge of 1970s incumbents of the TARDIS in Doctor Who. And you knew the answer. And I thought, he maybe does have something about him.
And so began a wonderful friendship. So we did. Yes, yeah, so we became good friends on the back of that, and we watched the whole of the director's cut of Lord of the Rings, didn't we? I remember that
we did because
you were in London at the time.
Yeah, because neither of our wives, certainly my wife, wouldn't watch it.
Had the slightest interest.
Yeah, had the slightest interest. So we had to watch
it. Boys' night in.
It was. Well, it was multiple nights, wasn't it? It was three nights of watching the director's cut of the Lord of the Rings. So when people say, why haven't you done Tolkien yet?
It's too precious. So we're saving that. I mean, there are certain subjects that both of us are very interested in. I think that always kind of generates a particular kind of synergy when we're discussing subjects that we both have views on.
Yeah. You'll talk about Tolkien and Christianity, of course, which you lambasted me about for not mentioning in my Unheard article.
Well, I think it's very fundamental to him, but yes. So it's a crucial part of him, but we'll talk about that. The 60s, I mean, that's a subject we're both very interested in.
That was fun. So we'd done our 60s live stream. We came out of that relatively unscathed. There wasn't a great flood of people leaving the club, which was a relief to see. Yeah. And you did your tremendous Bob Dylan impersonation.
Oh, yes. Yes, I've been waiting for the chance to do that.
Yeah.
But then specifically, how did we meet up to do the podcast? So my brother, and I'm sure lots of the listeners out there will also be listeners of We Have Ways, the podcast my brother does with Al Murray on the Second World War. And I didn't know anything about podcasts. And every time I saw him, he'd say, I've got to go and do a podcast. And I kind of said, well, can't you just leave it? Leave it for a week or something. He said, no, I've got to go and do it. And it seemed very odd. It just seemed kind of an annoying. And then he started talking it through, and that does sound quite interesting.
Wasn't it the point where he rocked up in his Rolls Royce or something that you thought?
that was certainly a kind of influence. No question about it. No, I think it was the chance to reach out and share my love of history with people.
Of course.
The overwhelming factor, but yeah, possibly was a kind of modifying influence. Jack, who's our producer, and Tony called me in and said, do you want to do something? I mean, we had a long discussion about whether it should be focused exclusively on ancient history, which was kind of the field I particularly knew about, or whether it should be history generally. And then there was a lengthy discussion about who we should ask. And so I went through a long list of all my friends and they refused to do it. And so finally I found Dominic.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, well, I mean, the really embarrassing thing, of course, is that for literally weeks, there was a long running WhatsApp debate about the title. What the podcast should be called.
Yeah.
And I think there was Magical History Tour at one point, wasn't there? I quite like Magical History Tour. But Tom was absolutely, I can remember you ringing me up and saying,
It was brilliant.
I mean, you were and you were so absolutely definite and certain. I thought, Christ, this is going to be hard to argue me out of it. You wanted to call it Podpast.
It's great.
I just don't think people would belong to a club.
The Podpast Club.
Because you wouldn't be able to say it to other people without hanging your head in shame.
I'm a member of the Podpast Club. I've just said it, and I'm not hanging my head in shame.
Well, you should be.
Well, it's a wasted opportunity. So anyway, so that's the backstory. I think you mentioned this on Twitter.
Yeah.
There is one episode that has not gone out.
The very first one.
Which we recorded in my daughter was at university at the time, so she had a kind of student house. And we met up in that and recorded it. And it was terrible, wasn't it? Because we just kind of lectured each other.
But it was also a sort of strange location to do, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we were just sort of in the student house.
But I think it reflected the fact we hadn't listened to any podcasts.
Yeah, it did. Because it wasn't chatty, was it?
No. So we just kind of aerated at one another.
It was like In Our Time, but without Melvin Bragg.
Yes. Yes. I mean, that's exactly what it was like. anyway, so that's the backstory.
Yes. Now, shall we do a couple of... Sam, our backroom chap, has sent us a great list of some of the top things from the Discord. He says there's been loads of discussion.
Mostly complimentary.
Only mostly complimentary about Dominic's Spectator article on the British education system teaching us to be ashamed about our past. I never said that. Let me just absolutely pin my colours to the mask. I never said that.
I am not a crook.
I never said the British education system was teaching us to be ashamed about our past. I said it was a shame that the sort of mood music around history is generally very negative. So it all emphasises kind of victimhood and guilt and historic crimes and restitution of artefacts. And the sort of tone is unfun. And I'm talking about history specifically for children.
And primary school.
Yeah, primary school children. I think for kind of primary school children, saying we're now, you know, what you're about to hear is troubling and will involve some challenging and disturbing conversations. No child wants to hear that. They want to hear it will involve a man scaling a mountain, a princess, tanks.
Well, I felt bad because I thought that I was helping out by quoting it. It got a lot of retweets.
It did get a lot of retweets.
Generated a lot of traffic. But it also, yes, you did, mostly complimentary sums it up.
Yeah.
But I think most of the negative comments were from people who hadn't twigged that you were talking about a specific age range.
Yes, that's right. I think that's absolutely right. That's
true. I mean, it's kind of like saying, you know, I mean, it's not just, you know, the bad things that Drake or Nelson got up to. I mean, you could do exactly the same, you know, the bad.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King wasn't great with women, or Mary Seacole wasn't really a nurse. I mean, you know, if you're giving children figures to admire, don't kind of major on the terrible things, because the terrible things will come later, and that's part of the fun.
Well, you have to bunk before you can debunk. That's what I always think.
You need to
put up the figures with feet of clay before you pull them down again. And I think,
but I mean, in a way, you know, doing GCSE or A level history it's about learning that everything that you studied at primary school is wrong.
It is actually,
and then
it?
And yeah. then you go to university and you discover everything you studied at A level is wrong.
Yeah,
I mean, that's all absolutely part of the fun of it.
I mean, that sort of conversation, that thing that people always say from the age of about 14 onwards, it's actually much more complicated than that.
Yes.
And actually, that's something you quite. I think that.
And then you become middle aged and you discover everything that you knew when you were six was right.
Yeah, but that's what I was about to say, that some people get addicted to that.
And Cromwell so was that, stolen by a monkey when he was
that,
a baby.
There's that thing that you get in academic seminars where people are always saying, no one can ever say anything. Because there's always the next person will always just say, ah, but it's much more complicated than that. Like, say something for God's sake. Just agree that, like, you know, Cromwell was stolen by a monkey or whatever it was. He wasn't, unfortunately. But that's our example, isn't it, of a historical untruth that should be taught in schools.
And that he fought Charles I as a young boy.
Now, another thing that you're very keen on is, apart from retweeting inflammatory articles, is cemeteries. And you've been pestering me.
Oh, no, I think that's a little bit harsh. I wouldn't say I'm keen on cemeteries, but I think it'd be a wonderful idea.
You love to. You're always talking about walking around cemeteries.
Yeah, I think it would be because it plays to your strengths, Dominic.
What, death and stones?
No. So specifically, the one I want to go to, and I've been agitating to do this ever since we started, is to go to Putney Vale Cemetery because it's got Kerensky.
Yeah.
So important player, obviously, in the Russian Revolution, and Hattie Jakes, star of
Carry On films. The world's greatest matron.
And I just feel that comprehensively plays to your strengths.
Yes, I suppose so. They're two people who I don't think met. Kerensky ended up teaching in America, didn't he? So
yeah.
Isn't that right?
Back, yeah, he got brought back to Putney.
Yeah.
By his children.
Did he? Is that why he... Well, we're doing the podcast now, aren't we?
Well, we'll find, have to do the research. But it's just my generosity of spirit.
So talking of locations for podcasts, Tom. So Newlyn Spike says, what about Brompton Cemetery in South Kensington?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Resting place of Chief Long Wolf, Emmeline Pankhurst, the prize fighter gentleman John Jackson.
Who was played by Errol Flynn.
Was he? And the Cortoy time machine, which I don't know what that is.
Don't know about that. It was also where John Snow, who discovered how to fix cholera, was buried.
Right.
And John Wisden.
The founder of Wisden.
The founder of Wisden Cricketer's Almanac.
So I had a suggestion come to me today, Tom, for an on-location podcast that I think will very much appeal to you. Because as you know, this last summer, we went on holiday to the Peloponnese and we stayed in Cardamyle,
yeah,
where Patrick Lee Firmus House is, where you've spent a lot of time.
Yeah.
And the lady who was kind of looking after our house where we were staying, she subsequently emailed me and said she was listening to The Rest Is History from the Peloponnese. She's Greek. And she discovered that I was on it and I had stayed at her house only a month before. And she sent me an email only a couple of days ago wishing me a very happy Christmas. And her name is Nina, if she's listening, and suggesting that we do a podcast from Cardamyle.
That'd be lovely.
Because it's there in the Mani in Greece, the Greek War of Independence.
But I've already done one. I've done a podcast from Cardamyle, haven't I?
Not with us, have you?
Yeah.
Not for our podcast.
What I did the we did the dinosaurs.
Did you do the dinosaurs?
I was in Cardamyle, yeah. And
yeah, but it wasn't about Cardamyle.
No, it wasn't about Cardamyle.
It could be like the trip. It could be like... I mean, basically, the key thing that we should arrange is for the producers to pay for it. I think that's the absolute...
Or maybe we could get Beer 52 to sponsor it.
Would they? Some sort of... would they do a Greek...
Mythos. A cooling glass of mythos.
Would BetterHelp not sponsor it, Tom? I mean, as a kind of chance to recharge your mental batteries?
Well, certainly worth thinking about, isn't it? Anyway, let's push on. Sergeant Musgrove, really pleased to hear there's going to be an episode with Rachel Morley. Yes, the Rachel Morley on the 10 most Christmassy churches. Looking forward to finding out about 27 Christmassy churches. That is not an exaggeration.
Yeah, well, we've done that, haven't we?
So. She's in prime form. Yeah, so that's out on Thursday. So do look out for that. It's everything that you might expect. Flashman Fan 69, the first live stream was an absolutely sacral experience.
I thought the first live stream was fun. So we're sort of juggling, talking to each other and all the great list of questions at the side, aren't we, in comments. So it's kind of hard to keep track of what's going on, but I'm sure we'll get used to it. And I think for the singing, I think the singing should be a regular element of the live streams, Tom.
Yeah, well, the problem is though there are only certain things that I can do brilliantly.
Yeah,
of which obviously Bob Dylan was one.
Can you do like if the next live stream is say the 30 Years War? Would you be
that's
able to
that's more of a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, some German folk ballad. Or something. Oh my God, was that your German?
I was thinking of kind of miserable old women trudging along with a cart or something.
Let's talk about a couple of recent episodes.
Superheroes and the Dukes of Burgundy.
And crickets, though, Tom, crickets.
Didn't we do cricket before?
Well, somebody, Tony Bang Reloaded, wants me to read out Bill Bryson. He says we need Dominic to read out some Bill Bryson on cricket. Bill Bryson wrote off cricket. I don't wish to denigrate a sport that is enjoyed by millions, some of them awake and facing the right way, but it is an odd game. It's the only sport that incorporates meal breaks. It's the only sport that shares its name with an insect. It's the only sport in which spectators burn as many calories as players, more if they're moderately restless. It's the only competitive activity of any type, other than perhaps baking, which you can dress in white from head to toe and be as clean at the end of the day as you were at the beginning. Tom Holland, how do you plead?
Well, I don't think Bill Bryson's ever fielded.
Well, it sounds like he has.
It doesn't sound like he has at all. I mean, anyone who's fielded knows that you come off with your whites covered in mud and grass stains.
Do you? I think that's a
wild
exaggeration.
Not at all. Well, I mean, it depends how committed to the team you are.
Yes. Well, you're very committed.
And as someone who has team, you know, you cut me.
Yeah.
And I bleed team.
Do you?
Yeah. I come off, I just absolutely covered in mud.
One question for you, Tom, before we move on from cricket. Harold Stassen has asked, former, what was he, governor of Minnesota, I think? Anyway, he's asked, on the question of cricket and empire, why didn't it catch on outside South Africa in Britain's other African colonies? Is it because they weren't there for long or because there weren't many British settlers? What's the reason?
It is played in Kenya.
Because there's a lot of settlers in Kenya, I suppose.
Yeah, so I guess you need to have either a kind of, it needs to be a settler society.
Yeah.
Like Australia, like New Zealand, and to a degree like South Africa. Or it needs to have a long and continuous presence, say like the West Indies or India.
Yeah.
And the African colonies were very short term.
Yeah. Let me ask you another follow-up question to that. Surely one of the other outlying places where they should play cricket and don't is Argentina, because they play polo and rugby and they have gentlemen's clubs. And they had a huge kind of presence of British merchants and sort of shipping agents and stuff. Why don't they play cricket, or do they?
Again, it's equivalent of royal tennis, I think, in Buenos Aires.
Right.
That it is played, but it's a kind of aristocratic affectation.
Yeah.
You know, there are cricket clubs in Buenos Aires, and it would be wonderful to go on tour there. But it's very much not the sport of the people.
You've been on a tour to Iceland. You should definitely go.
Yeah, so I've played cricket in some amazing places. I've been on two tours to India, two tours to Sri Lanka. We've played at the Vatican.
Yeah.
Literally in front of St. Peter's.
Was the Pope playing?
No, the Pope wasn't playing, sadly. But we had a cricket-themed mass directly under St. Peter's tomb, which is a kind of, you know, money, spirits money can't buy you. And we played in Iceland. We played in Corfu.
Yeah.
So some wonderful locations.
Is Corfu the only place in Greece where they play cricket?
Yeah, they play it very well.
Do they?
Well, we kind of went out there thinking, yeah, it's going to be a walkover. And the size of the kind of the beefy police chiefs who have been playing cricket since they were five absolutely hammered us.
So there, they actually are genuine Greeks playing. They're not kind of South Africans who work in the bars or something.
No, they're Greek and they're really, really good.
But Iceland, the Icelanders don't really play cricket, do they?
They were all Sri Lankan.
Yeah.
And having been on two tours to Sri Lanka, in which we lost every single match, the experience of turning up in indoor football stadium outside Reykjavik and hearing the excited chatter of very good Sri Lankan cricketers was like a kind of pack of lions seeing a herd of zebra heading towards the watering hole as they saw us shuffling into the stadium, and they murdered us.
Oh dear, oh dear. All right, well, let's get to the meat of the of today's podcast.
Yes, they're superheroes.
Superheroes. So
I like the comment from Sergeant Musgrove. It was good of Dominic to get his dad on for this episode. Will Tom be back next week? I suppose I was a bit of a grump.
We got a lot of commentary on Twitter about this, about which I think is so my take on this is that superheroes is one of those subjects about which people feel incredibly proprietorial. Actually, Tolkien, which we've mentioned already, is another. And things like Star Wars or Doctor Who and some sports, I think, are not dissimilar. And people are often very deep, grievously offended if they feel that their interest and their passion is being taken too lightly.
But Dominic, also, you know, this is not a cinema or a comic book podcast. It's specifically about history, and it's about to what extent are superheroes interesting as a theme in themselves,
yeah,
or as a mirror held up to.
But you said that you didn't think they were interesting.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. What I said was, and I think it's true, is that to begin with, they were.
Yeah.
So I think that their origins is interesting. I think the way that they evolve over the course of the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s is interesting. I think that recently they are less so. Now, that's not to say that the individual films may not be incredibly entertaining. They obviously are. They're massively successful. I would never, mm-hmm. Dismiss things that people enjoy. I enjoy all kinds of stuff. I'm sure I'd enjoy them if I went to see Spider-Man, which I'm boycotting as a matter of principle. But I'm sure it's... You went to see it, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I thought it was very good. It was a very unusual experience in the cinema. And actually, if you're interested in history and you're interested in popular culture, very revealing because I'm not going to spoil it because not everybody will have seen it. And there'll no doubt be some people who listening to this who are intending to see it and haven't got around to it because of COVID or whatever. But there were moments in that film where characters appeared, sort of fan favorite characters. And I'm not kidding. Some of the audience, maybe a fifth of the audience in the cinema in Whitney in Oxfordshire, started clapping and cheering. They were so excited. And that is so un-English and so unusual for people to react like that in the cinema.
But presumably you have to have watched all these films to get the point.
No, because the point was kind of obvious, Tom. I can't give it away. But the point, okay. As soon as the character appeared and people were going mad with excitement.
So what, like Batman or something?
Kind of.
But it's not Batman, is it? It's not Batman.
But it's not just another superhero. It's something more than that. And, I was there with my 10-year-old and he was actually as excited about the people clapping and cheering as he was about the...
Yeah, well, it's a great common location. So I completely, I'm not dissing it as an entertainment experience. I'm just asking, what does it hold up? There was something I wanted that I was kind of groping towards saying when we were talking about the state of the Marvel universe, whatever it is now. And that is that the early superheroes were reflections of America. It was deeply rooted in American culture and therefore fascinating for that reason. Actually, what I didn't articulate this well because I was kind of only groping towards it. But actually, I think the reason why the ones now are so successful globally and not just American is that in a way, they have become things that kind of make them specifically American. They've been slightly drained of that.
I don't think that's necessarily true. Now, some people. So the Marvel Cinematic Universe was launched with Iron Man, and that was very much an America in Afghanistan story.
He's the one who dresses up in metal.
Yes, as you put it, hilariously, and that was very much all war on terror. That first film, an American experience in Afghanistan. And I don't know. I mean, the Spider-Man is still very much kind of an American high school story. And of course, that's a fantasy, the American high school story that now much of the world shares because of the Americanization of popular culture generally. But I don't think I don't think they're historically kind of meaningless or irrelevant. I mean, obviously, they're historically important. And actually,
okay, so what do they tell us?
Well, actually, do you know what, Tom? Because they're so contemporary, I think it's hard to say. I think when we're a few decades down the line, we'll be able to look back at them and say, okay, God, that's so much of the 2010s or that's so much of the 2000s. But also, actually, I was thinking about this and afterwards, because you said, you often said, what does it tell us? What is that? But that sort of suggests that it's purely interesting because it tells us something beyond itself. But I think it's interesting in and of itself, not just as a mirror. So even like the original Spider-Man stories from the 1960s, I mean, the relationship between sort of Peter and his classmates, Peter and his, the Peter character in himself, I mean, that's very, all of that is very kind of revealing about the anxieties of kind of American teenagers in the early 1960s, I think. I mean, it's a bit like me saying to you about Beowulf or something. Well, what does it tell us? I want to know what it reveals, blah, 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 blah. But you might eventually say it's just interesting in and of itself.
I completely agree. But, but if there'd be a difference if we were talking about Beowulf on a literature podcast, on a podcast that was devoted to the study of Beowulf as a work of literature.
Yeah.
We're not. We'd be interested in Beowulf as a historical artifact, in what it suggests about, the background to it, all that kind of thing. I mean, there's a kind of difference of emphasis, whether you're doing a historicist or a literary approach to it.
Sure.
And likewise with films, I mean, you can talk about them as films, as cinema, And that's in, obviously, I mean, that's what they are. They're not, they're not producers getting, let's make a historical artifact that will show revealing facets about America in the early 21st century. I mean, that's not what they're doing. They're making massive juggernaut entertainment vehicles. And that, and obviously they're incredibly successful at that. So,
but I think to future historians, they'll be very revealing about the technological fixations of our age, celebrity culture, the media.
But do you not think, I mean, also that they reflect an age in which, in a way, America is less important because it the sales are dependent on them having traction in China and in East Pacific, you know, in East Asia and so on. So in a sense, they have to, some of the cultural specificity has to be drained from it.
A little, I think there may be some truth in that.
You know, I haven't seen, you know, I haven't seen this, so I don't know.
This
so
is
I'm
my dad talking.
Exactly, so I'm just repeating what I've read in, you know.
But I think there's some truth in that because they have definitely become more Asian. And when we were watching the Spider-Man film, I was thinking, you know, it could be a sort of committee-designed sort of cast in the sense that Spider-Man is Tom Holland. You know, he's kind of white,
is he?
Anglo-Saxon. Yeah. MJ, his girlfriend, is kind of mixed race, played by Zendaya, and his best friend is an Asian-American. You know, so it's sort of ticking every, sort of fat Asian-American. So it's kind of ticking every box. One other thing that's very interesting about these films, Tom, actually, from the point of view of the sort of globalization of popular culture is how English they are. How many English people?
Are they, but they're not playing, but they're English actors playing.
But there are whole scenes, right? There are whole scenes where there are three or four people on in the on screen, all of whom are British and all of whom are putting on American accents. So, for example, you've got Tom Holland and Benedict Cumberbatch and a guy called Benedict Wong, I think his name is, who is Cumberbatch's assistant, who is a kind of Chinese British
actor.
But
that's because British actors are cheaper.
They're cheap. Well, they're better, surely.
Well, discuss. I mean, I just wonder whether because it's often said about English as the lingua franca that native speakers are often at a disadvantage in international business meetings because they use all kinds of idioms that mean nothing to the kind of speakers of business English who've learned whatever, you know, 5,000 words and basic grammar, and that's what all you need to communicate. Whereas if you're doing, you know, metaphorical language or whatever, or peculiar idioms rooted in...
If you're kicking the bucket.
19th century, yes, exactly. It becomes hard. And maybe superhero films are cinema directed at the kind of people who speak business English. Is that unfair?
See, that's going to get you more grief from the listeners.
Okay, all right. Okay.
You just can't help yourself. Okay, let's take a couple of questions that people...
There's a good thing on Black Panther.
Yes, McRoby says... Setting the Black Panther. Now, you may remember this is where we did our live research, our groundbreaking live research by looking up Wikipedia articles about Black Panther. So, but Roby says the Black Panthers were named after a description of Malcolm X by Helen Handler, the wife of journalist Michael Handler, who quoted her in his introduction to the autobiography of Malcolm X. The superhero Black Panther, whose creation, as Dominic noted, preceded the formation of the group by 2 months in 1966, was also probably inspired by the book, which was published in 1965. That's slightly confusing, but the book comes first.
And inspires these two things.
And actually, Black Panther is, I think, a really good rebuke to your. I mean, it's the perfect answer, actually. The perfect riposte to your thing about what do they tell us? What mirror do they hold up? Because the introduction to the Black Panther story in, 1966... And its adoption in the 2010s is very revealing about American.
All right, I take it back.
Racial attitudes. Mary Kirk, big fan of Wonder Woman. When you know the backstory, the feminism is complicated at best. But as a kid, seeing her through the lens of 80s television cartoons, all that was lost on me. I think Wonder Woman was amazing. Well, Wonder Woman is another one, Tom, you know, that, again, she's become a feminist icon, hasn't she, Wonder Woman?
I did see the recent one in the trenches.
Did you? I haven't seen it.
I did see that. I did
and
see
was it
that.
Good?
Yeah, it was all right. I mean, it's a bit silly.
Right.
I don't remember any particular emphasis on bondage.
Right. Yeah, they've probably taken that out, haven't they?
I think that was...
Dave Walters says, Dominic mentioned that something wasn't technically history, which made me wonder what is technically history. Did I say that?
Charles Babbage is technically history.
Very good. Isabel Kingdom Brunel.
Yes.
I think everything is history, personally. Yeah, I do. It's a weird thing with a lot of historians are very reluctant to use popular culture
Are you, Dominic?
No, I'm not.
Or have you written a series of studies of modern Britain in which popular culture regularly features?
But when I first was teaching and we were doing America in the 1930s and I made the students read The Grapes of Wrath, or The Grapes of Wrath, as they would, John Steinbeck would no doubt have called it, some of my colleagues said, golly, very unusual getting them to read a novel.
Did you get them to do Superman?
No, I should have done.
Because you should have done.
I absolutely should have done.
I completely agree that...
Yeah, I absolutely should have done. In fact, that was a terrible missed opportunity, that course. Because I was very... I basically had about 3 days to dream it up.
Yeah.
So it was done in a great rush. And I could have done it so much better and put in lots more interesting things about, I don't know, music and film and stuff.
Cartoons.
But I was lazy and was in the middle of a very exacting season on Championship Manager.
Well, I'm sure your students are thrilled to hear that.
Well, I can get away with it now. It's 20 years ago. I think the big hit of our recent podcasts really was Burgundy, don't you?
You wouldn't have said that was a banker, would you?
I wouldn't, because you booked in Bart Van Loo, didn't you? You saw it coming. And then I reviewed his book for the Sunday Times and was very relieved.
Well, I tell you why. The topic of the Dukes of Burgundy came up somewhere in some Twitter conversation. And I said, ooh, you know, love the Dukes of Burgundy, did it for A-level, that kind of thing. And armies of Belgians piled in and said, you've got to have Bart Van Loo.
Yeah.
And clearly there was a Belgium-wide consensus as to this. So I signed him up. And then you got his book to review. So it's lucky you liked it.
Well, Thomas a devil for signing people up randomly, like when I and the producers are asleep or something. Well, I wake up.
I just meet strangers in pubs.
There'll be some message from Tom saying, I hope you don't mind, but next April, I've signed up so-and-so.
I'll tell you the best one of that, Gordon Carrera,
yeah,
the BBC intelligence correspondent. So,
yeah,
you know, spies and stuff. And I met him at a carol service. And I've signed him up to do the history of the pigeon. See, he's written a book about the use of pigeons by spies.
I mean, you couldn't make it up. Anyway.
But pigeon is a great subject.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think you're going to have to do a good job pre-selling it to the audience.
But like the Dukes of Burgundy.
Well, Burgundy. So I reviewed his book and I thought it was absolutely excellent. And then he emailed me and said how much he was looking forward to the podcast. There was a sentence in his email that struck utter fear and dread into my heart when he said, my English isn't very good. And I thought, oh no, this is going to be terrible. So I was quite nervous when he logged on and there he was. And then the first thing he said to us before we started recording, wasn't it, that he'd just done a French podcast and they'd been very humorless. And he realised from our sort of pre-match banter that this wasn't going to be the case.
Very different with John Bull.
Yeah, exactly. And I thought he was brilliant. I really did. No,
he knew how to flatter us.
He did. But he had all the right anecdotes and it was great. His book absolutely captures that.
Joseph F. Oh man, Bart was hilarious on this past episode. Excellent guest, very energetic and fun. I breathed a huge sigh of arousal after the episode.
Yes. That was probably my favourite moment when he said, you both breathed a sigh of arousal now.
Yeah. I was aroused, as I said.
But actually, we had a couple of people. Cy James is one of them. He says, I can't believe you didn't get Bart onto Passport to Pimlico, the last great shout of the Burgundians. So Passport to Pimlico, for anybody who doesn't know, is an absolutely wonderful film, an Ealing comedy from, what is it, the late 40s, 50s, early 50s. I can't remember the date, actually. I think it's maybe one of the earlier Ealing comedies. So it's set in the sort of, you know, austerity
Blitzed,
Britain.
Bombed out London.
Austerity Britain. And the people of Pimlico discover that thanks to this sort of ancient treaty, they're actually part of the Duchy of Burgundy.
Yeah, they're Burgundians.
So they end up having passports and all this sort of stuff. It's very funny. It's actually a lovely film to watch at Christmas because it's very good humoured. And
yeah, I got sent the link to it by Daisy, who was on Talking About Exams.
We should do one on the Ealing comedies. They're such fantastic films. Sergeant Musgrave, who I think we quoted earlier, he, says, I wonder if there's any parallels to be drawn to the role of Burgundy in relation to France and that of Wales to England. Tom, what do you think about that? I don't think that... Because Burgundy was richer. It was so rich. Wales was never especially rich, was it, compared to medieval England?
I think the French Wales is Brittany.
Yeah, yeah. Tony Bang Reloaded asks a good question. Why? What were the Holy Roman Empire doing at this point in Burgundy? I suppose the answer to that is that the Holy Roman Empire was so fragmented... It wasn't doing anything. Bart described it as a superpower, but was it a superpower in the 15th century?
A sleeping giant, I believe, is the cliche one.
Yeah, because it doesn't really become a big superpower until...
it's the Habsburgs, isn't it?
Habsburgs,
It's the Habsburgs who realise the dynastic potential.
Once they've got Spain and the Empire and South America and the Low Countries.
Just go around grabbing it. So one of the people that I have recruited in the way that Dominic is suspicious of is Eduard Habsburg, who is, I think, the Hungarian ambassador to the Vatican.
In very Habsburg fashion, I had another Habsburg in mind, because I know a guy called Max von Habsburg, who's the head of history at a school in Oxford. And I thought he would have been perfect for the Habsburgs.
Well, should we have them both on?
But you had your own... Well, they might not be on... You know what the Habsburgs are like. They might not be on speaking terms or something.
But that'd be quite exciting, wouldn't it?
There might be some terrible sort of row about the, you know, the archducal inheritance or something.
All to look forward to. Okay, so we will be back with you on Thursday with Rachel doing her top 10 Christmas churches. So we will see you then.
Goodbye.